Hi, welcome to Androids and Assets. I'm Marshall.
And I'm Steven.
Today we have our guest, Rick Harp. Rick's, I guess now he's host and producer of Media Indigena, but he has an extensive experience in journalism, going back years to As It Happens, and then lots of time spent with the Aboriginal People's Television Network, APTN. You were host of a national news there, co-anchor.
Co-anchor of the newscast, and yeah. I also hosted a national live call-in program called, at the time, Contact, but it's not on anymore.
I think that's often how journalism goes, right? The host sort of makes the show. and then he was in Edmonton again.
That's right.
Doing Edmonton AM.
That's right. And an ungodly hour.
Yeah, that's a show that I never hear.
You're not up at 5:30 in the morning until 8:30.
I listened to it once. I was driving so much to the airport.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was a lot of fun, and I made a lot of great connections and friendships. So it was in many ways a very fond time.
Yeah, fantastic. And now Media Indigena. So can you tell us just a little bit about that?
Well, it's a weekly current affairs program, and so what we do is we try to track what's making headlines mostly in the mainstream media, sometimes in quote-unquote niche media like Windspeaker, national Indigenous newspaper. Sometimes, so this week we did a live taping of the podcast, and we talked about a tweet. So in some ways, I feel that, some people call it native Twitter or Indigenous Twitter. And so sometimes that's the landscape upon which we, seek out possible inspirations for discussions. So it's basically, I'm ripping this off from another source. It's not coming to mind who, but we're not so much content providers, we're context providers. So I think what we try to do is destabilize lazy thinking, and we're not necessarily about throwing facts at something and hoping that will somehow, transmogrify somebody's mind about something, but it's just, we're trying to, make people realize it's probably more complicated than it at first glance appears. And it's a very relaxed format. It's a round table. It's four academics, and they rotate two at a time. I'm the constant. And I'll talk to Candace Collison, who's now a visiting professor at Princeton in New Jersey, but she's on leave from UBC, where she teaches a master's of journalism. And there's Kim Tallbear, University of Alberta. She teaches in the Faculty of Native Studies. Ken Williams, he's also at the U of A. He's a professor of drama. And last but not least, Brock Pitawanakwat, who is a professor of Indigenous Studies at in Sudbury, at the University of Sudbury. So, we're all based in different parts. Two are based in Edmonton and the rest are scattered all over North America. So I'm based out of Winnipeg, and, we do these conversations once a week, and sometimes topics come up more than once, but you always try to bring a new, fresh, angle to it. But it's been rare that we've had to cover the same ground twice. There's just so much out there, and 130 episodes later, I think we've built up quite a set of intellectual muscles, as it were, it's been a great learning experience to trying to translate for our audience just some of the stuff that's making the news, which is usually, I'm sort of over explaining this, but just usually you get the surface coverage, and we try to dig a little deeper.
I heard an anecdote. It's like a page one day, and then next week page 17, and then the third week not at all.
I think that's things don't have a long shelf life or get a lot of oxygen unless there's some new way of stoking it.
Well, and that you're the new way.
There we go.
That's awesome. So one of the things you talked when we went to your live show, and we loved it. And one of the things you guys talked about was awards.
Right.
You know, kind of like what would Indigenous.
Well, specifically Arts Awards.
Arts Awards, right. Yeah. And so, like, kind of what the. What is. How do the Indigenous. Well, Indigenous communities, I guess, recognize their content creators and,
yeah.
and their voice and their message. And I mean, we talk a lot about actually awards and from a science fiction perspective, and there's quite a rich science fiction tradition amongst yeah. Indigenous people. And for me, Drew Hayden Taylor is like the person who most recently
okay.
immediately comes to mind. But there's been some major splashes in the Hugos even this year. Marshall, you want to talk about that? You were there.
Rebecca Roanhorse, who won Hugo and the John W. Campbell Award, which officially is not a Hugo, but is given out by the exact same committee as the Hugos and voted on by the same people as the Hugos.
So it's like the Nobel Prize of Economics?
Yeah, essentially. Yes. Yeah, it's a Nobel Prize, but
relatively the actual Nobel Prize.
Yeah. It's the exact same award ceremony and all the prestige.
Okay.
It just comes with a tiara. So instead of a...
Seriously?
Yeah, seriously.
Oh, okay. Made of solid gold, I hope.
Can you sell it?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, it's on eBay the next day. Boom.
And so she won Best Short Story for Welcome to Your Authentic Indian Experience, and then Best New Author, I think, for both the short story and also a novel that she'd released, Trail of Lightning. So, in her... acceptance speeches, because she had two of them. Mm-hmm. Well, really one, because she didn't expect to win both awards.
Okay.
So she got up and said, well, I only wrote one of these. I didn't even know if I'd get any awards.
Yeah, yeah.
She said she's, you know, the first Black and Indigenous person to win the John W. Campbell Award, which is really something.
Yeah.
And just to be recognized for stories that are unabashedly... Indigenous stories. They have yeah. Indigenous characters. They weren't just, you know, a typical space story that had an Indigenous character. It was about Indigenous culture and
it was Indigenous centric. They weren't props. They weren't
right.
some landscape against which white people can realize their dreams or worst fears, as the case may be.
Exactly. Yeah.
I've not read them, but I mean, this is a familiar
yes. No, I'm
issue.
I'm, yeah. And so I think it's really nice to see that not only being done, but also yeah. being recognized for being accomplished and
yeah.
and well done.
Mm-hmm. And so you were struck by the fact
there.
That it's a mainstream award given to an Indigenous writer.
Yeah.
Is there an Indigenous-driven equivalent? Is that? And I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, and I don't know if there's an Indigenous equivalent, but...
I mean, for me, I think it's apt because science fiction is often like, I mean... Our fellow podcasters, Métis in Space, have a whole
yeah.
podcast about
yeah,
this, and they're
yeah.
great. But they, you know, this concept that science fiction actually has embedded in its DNA kind of a colonial bent. So I think in that sense, we thought it was very significant because it's kind of like undermining that. I think it's a very big part of its history of, you know, white people in space going to other places and essentially colonizing
yeah.
them.
Yeah, yeah, new frontier.
Yeah, yeah, new frontier. Yeah, and like, in, yeah, so I guess for us then the question becomes like, what are the things exciting you kind of about Indigenous, like, literature right now and Indigenous, like, particularly I think Indigenous conceptions of the future, like what it will look like for...
You know, I don't have these days as much time as I would like to consume any content, period, except that which is going to end up on the program. So I hear a lot of buzz about different works like Thomas Orange's There, which is apparently unusual in its focus on Indigenous urban experiences. It's a work of fiction as well. And, yeah, no, I mean, I think, unfortunately, I am probably the worst person to ask about, you know, I think Métis in Space, they would be a great, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you do two interviews in one show, but that, but I mean, I think I come across discussions of futurism for different quote unquote cultural communities, you know, Afrofuturism and the like. And, so there's an interesting turn of phrase that's been happening of late where if somebody's talking about Thunder Bay, they'll say Thunder Bay in the province currently called Ontario, or in the country currently called Canada. And it's almost like this futuristic perspective, this look at, well, it wasn't Canada before, and it may not be Canada down the road. And it's an interesting twist of phrase, I think. I mean, it is what it is. That's the whole sum of it, but it's an interesting positionality, I think, in terms of looking at how young Canada really is in the big scheme of things relative to peoples who've lived here for millennia, right? And I've often struggled with how to just to convey that, you know, because I think people like, well, you're here with me right now, and that's as far as I can look. Like, you know, it's just like, I can't conceive of, you know, you're speaking English. Like, it's just, they're not able to compute that, you know, these cultures, which are undergoing, like any other culture, you know, constant processes of change and evolution, if you want to call it that. But nonetheless, you know, have a long, long, long presence in this part of the world. So I would love to see a lot more Indigenous science fiction enjoy the prominence of Trail of Lightning, for sure. And so that has gotten me very excited. And I know you want to talk about the other book before the show. You mentioned The Marrow Thieves, which I think is, yeah, that's the one piece of fiction that I've managed to read, because I read it to my 12-year-old that night. So
as you were talking, it made me think of there was sort of a slight controversy just before the Hugos. Mm. There were some authors that were nominated for awards and weren't given panels to speak about the works, which is sort of a traditional thing.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know how exactly where it came from or how widespread it was, but one of the authors received an email that said, well, you know, own voices isn't something that a lot of people know about. And so, you know, to
own voices,
Hashtag own voices. Oh. So it's like, authors writing about their own experiences. So,
oh, okay.
Women and people of color primarily writing women and people of color stories, instead of something like a white man writing Indigenous stories or,
right. Okay.
Sorry. You know, you get to tell your own story. And it's been sort of a thing on Twitter of you know, they want to write their own stories and own voices is yeah. important.
Okay.
And they said, well, own voices as a movement isn't widely known and isn't popular, and we want to remain relevant for the majority of our conference attendees. So yeah, that's why we didn't give you a panel. And they retorted with, well, we were nominated for an award by the people. Like, wait, there has to be some amount of popularity there to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
These sort of the
top
six.
Didn't Black Panther do kind of okay at the box office? Yeah.
Well, and that's kind of what I thought, is that then you have N.K. Jemisin, who does Afrofuturism.
Yeah.
Won for the third time in a row. You had Rebecca Roanhorse winning for Best Short Story. And it was just a cast of non-binary people of color,
yeah,
winning award after award.
Wow.
So it's kind of nice that even though maybe there might be some sort of gatekeepers that are still there saying, I don't know how popular you are.
Well, are the identities of these gatekeepers known? Like, and is there a pretty clear homogeneity among them? And
I mean, like, there's volunteers that run each convention, and it's a different volunteer group each year.
Okay.
And nobody knows exactly where the email originated. And
okay. Oh, geez.
There's some at least anonymity that was maintained. They said, I got this email, and I'm not going to say who it came from because I was pretty offended by it, and I think they should have a chance to.
That's pretty generous of that.
I thought so. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Wow.
But it's nice to see that even though there's some people who maybe underestimate the popularity of it,
yeah,
when it comes to actual fans and people creating these things, it's super popular,
yeah,
and very widespread. So it's not just a niche small thing, mm-hmm, anymore that you have to search out. It's it's mainstream, and that's...
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's... Well, I mean, maybe it sounds like, yeah, the, I don't know if we want to call it the science fiction community, right? If we're not going to use that for any group now, right? Because the indigenous community, what the hell does that mean, right? But, and I'm guilty of using it, so I'm not on a soapbox here. But, yeah, maybe it's going through its moment of awakening in terms of just the diversity of voices. And these things don't happen overnight, so... people are waking up. So it, but I'm glad to see it's a debate, and hopefully it moves beyond that and just reflects the reality.
Yeah. Nothing is more mainstream than people.
You're right.
But I, and going back to the Marrow Thieves, because I mean, like, I mean, the whole concept of the Marrow Thieves and this mm-hmm. concept of, like, again, it's this, and Kim Tallbear, like, I totally thought of Kim Tallbear and, like, yeah. this notion of, like, you know, like her work around, like, indigenous genomes. And stuff, mm-hmm. like, you know, so this and everything, again, one of the things we keep bumping into when we should talk about the future, to where we're going, property becomes mm-hmm. a huge, mm-hmm. it's a huge question mark over property and what we're going to do about it. Is it going to become further entrenched? Are we going to dissociate from it? But property, it's really driving a lot of this stuff in this notion that, again, this, you know, when Europeans came over here, they were largely a corporation, right? They were just a corporation that came here to take out natural resources and then also, you know, cultural and human power out of the continent to take back to Europe. Where do, like, property conceptions across different indigenous groups is, right. and there's no homogeneity. They,
right.
Each community has their own conception of property. But I think in general, there's a sense that there are indigenous notions of property that could better serve humanity now.
Perhaps. I mean, I would like to look more into that aspect in terms of, you know, I guess economics broadly, political economics broadly defined, and how indigenous people conceive of wealth and property, who has claims to ownership or at least control of resources, right? And, you know, they can vary widely. It may be somewhat, you know, tailored to the geography and the topography of the space. So, you know, you hear, although again, I don't know, it's just become this kind of generic notion that on the Pacific Northwest, there was greater hierarchy because there was a surplus generated, you know, the salmon mm-hmm. basically was just like gold, and that allowed them to tailor that allowed them to shape their economy in certain directions. And that had political implications. And then you have quote unquote hunter gatherers who, you know, popular depictions make them seem like, you know, they're almost ready to eat their own feces. Food is so scarce, right? And, you know, Thomas Hobbes and the State of Nature and all this nonsense about how indigenous people supposedly live. And it's like, you know, I don't know. You know, there's always this handy excuse. Well, you know, their thoughts and attitudes were products of their time. But it's just like, how do you think people could live in a parcel of land for thousands of years, generations upon generations, and not know a thing or two about how to feed themselves, right? And
yeah.
and how to, you know, every scarcity, you know, prior to super industrialization, I think was not something unfamiliar to most people. So you figure out, you maximize, optimize systems of storage for tough times, right? I mean, so I don't know. It just... People project what they want to project in order to justify their behavior of pillaging.
Yeah.
And, yeah. And it is, I think, you know, people do talk about indigenous economics, but so often it's simply looking at indigenous capitalism, and there can be a lot of room for different versions within that. And there's some collective forms of economic driven and economic development, and the proceeds are distributed, you know, throughout the nation. So, you know, casinos have what are called per capita, you know, payments distributed, just like Alaska does in terms of its fund. You know, but it's interesting. There's an economist I really like named Ha-Joon Chang, and he talks a lot about how Singapore, the state, owns most of the housing, and they make decisions about, you know, and Singapore is not necessarily a model you want to follow in all respects, but he says you claim it's impossible for a state to manage housing, well, Singapore is this major economic force, and yet somehow it's not purely capitalist. It doesn't have a housing market, right? And I've often thought there are some things in life that should not be subjected to market dynamics, and housing is one of them. And so, you know, I think there's a real tension in some indigenous communities where they're like, well, we want to be like any other jurisdiction in Canada, you know, off reserve, where you can own your house. And because, you know, we valorize home ownership so much in this, in this society. But it's not efficient if we're going to, I mean, it may be efficient in terms of.
But everybody in their context has to figure out what's going to work for what thing. And this is the issue that somebody has this cooker cutter solution of like, okay, people are going to own their houses. Stamp.
Yeah. Well, there's big chunks of Europe where home ownership is just not the priority it is in North America. So, you know, they're more or less comparable groups of people, right? So why the difference? But yeah, you're almost a pariah if you don't at least aspire to own a home. But it's funny. I'm reading a book. I can't remember the author, but I think it's Andrew Sayers. It's called Why We Can't Afford the Rich. And he says, you know, if I have a car,
yeah,
and I try to sell it, it doesn't appreciate, but a house does. Explain that, right? And I mean, I guess the difference is one is a lot more scarce than the other, right? And so why is housing scarce? That's the, you know, why is nobody talk about that? I mean, so how did this society produce a situation where there's not enough housing to go around? So anyway, so indigenous people have different indigenous peoples. I always stress the plurality. No, that's the wrong use of that word. But anyway, you know, they have different values, but there are some broad, very broad values that seem to cohere or, you know, persist across. And I think certainly a commitment to survival as a distinct people, it would be one of them, right? But that's, I don't know if that's a value just so much as a
grim necessity.
You know, yeah. Like, so it, but, you know, reciprocity, relation, you know, being strong kin. I mean, these are things I think that they'll take on different permutations, but I think, but then, you know, in some ways they seem almost universal, but of course they articulate differently in different scenarios.
Yeah. So we have in us both the potential for a future of, you know, improved relations and also the future of the Merrill thieves.
Right.
The future of our past.
Have you talked about the Merrill thieves on your show?
So
for those who may not know, right, the premise is that, geez, you don't want to give it away, right? But I mean, basically, indigenous people are, you know, all their resources have been under siege almost since Canada was formed. And in this scenario, indigenous people themselves become a resource. Their very bodies become a resource. So this is a story of a group of people trying to not be tracked down and extracted. Have a substance extracted from them.
Harvested.
Yeah, exactly. So, but it's a young adult book, and it's written by, I'm going to mispronounce her name, Sherry Dimelin.
Yeah.
But it's spelled Cheridimaline. So I apologize to her for probably botching it. But yeah, it's a great fast read. Apparently it's been optioned for television. I don't know if it's going to be a series, but
that would be awesome.
Yeah, it'd be really awesome. So looking forward to it. You were talking about some treaty thing. What if the treaties are you talking about some author who's looking into that?
I met down when I was at the Hugo Awards Worldcon in August, and she was talking about a novel that she has coming up that she's working on, wherein the treaties when they were made were unbreakable, and I'm not sure by what the force they would be, what mechanism makes them unbreakable, and that's probably part of the science fiction of it. And so
lasers
it's sort of
from
a
the sky, probably.
So
chip implants that blow up on I don't know. I got the
So yeah, I mean, there's sort of a science fictional thing that
would
you
say
alternate...
it's more speculative? I mean, I don't know the difference between the two. Alternate,
yes. There's a branch of alternate of science fiction that is alternate history, and that's always sort of an interesting thing to me. That it's, you know, science fiction is often, if we had a new technology, and alternate histories are sort of what if we had a new technology in the past, or if something, I mean, that's sort of like a science fiction alternate history, but there's a departure point sometime in the past, and how would the world look either now or at the time after that departure from our experienced history. I think looking at something like that and saying we had these agreements and what if we actually did follow them? Has a really neat potential to reimagine how Canada could look, and like you were saying earlier, there's lots of ways that might we can look at groups now in the world, and imagine how might we have responded in a different way than Canada sort of has, where, you know, there's the North American attempted genocide.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thought experiment. It always reflects the individual author's, you know, understanding and ability, to consult widely and weave it into a compelling narrative. No small feat, right? So, but if the general thrust is, well, what if they honored the treaties in a way that held up the honor of the crown and was actually conciliatory? I mean, people talk about reconciliation. I'm like, well, show me where the conciliation first happened, and then we can talk about its reboot or whatever. And it's just like, so the term I use, I probably heard it somewhere. I don't necessarily want to take credit for it, but we're more interested in, as the Indigenous community, as First Nations, as having reckoning, right? Mm. What was taken? What was stolen? What was attacked? And then just doing a mirror image of that as the agenda by which we go forward. So, you know, it's interesting to think about, like if there, so there's a book I would recommend, one of a number of books looking at the impact of disease. Like, disease was the X factor, but it's only the X factor because it kind of just got, people decided Indigenous people were inferior, period. Right. And I think even the understanding of maybe nothing like what we know about how disease works, but I think it was sufficient at the time that you could tally its impact. You could say, well, looking at all the factors, probably disease wiping out, you know, like decimating, like literally the meaning of that word, like maybe even more in some cases. How do you come back from that, right? And it's a testament to the strength and resilience of Indigenous cultures that they did. An essay to really read, and you should talk to her too, is a professor, she's been on the podcast, Kutcha Risling Baldy. And she basically says, what if The Walking Dead was real? And it's like, basically, well, it was. I mean, if you look, because The Walking Dead is about a dystopia, apocalypse. Like, what would happen if
mass casualties
in society? Yeah, and you had to pick up the pieces with who was and what was left with fragments, right? And she's just, she just amazingly laid it all out, and she would be wonderful to talk to. I mean, about a grim, but
that's what we want.
There you go. Yeah, that's sweet spot, you know. So, you know, I think of all those things, and a book I would recommend is called Clearing the Plains by James Dashuk. And he uncovers the horrible, deliberate use and leverage of famine as a tool of Indigenous policy. And basically he knows that people are starving, and he knows that if he promises them food, They'll just do whatever the hell they want to get to the next day, literally.
Yeah. Well, I think it's kind of synchronous, like you're talking about famine, because I was just reading about British Empire and its use of famine.
Okay.
Like, you know, so North America was, I don't know if it's a laboratory is the right word, but it's definitely a place where they use famine as a weapon to, you know, I mean, unknown, to horrific ends. But also India, like they, I've said in a previous podcast, the British Empire killed a million, had a Holocaust. Like the Olympics.
Was that during Churchill's era?
Completely from 1770 is when the first Bengal famine is, and so from like the 1700s straight on through to the 20th century, the British were taking food out of people's mouths while they starved and by the millions.
So it's a playbook. It's a colonial playbook, and it's just, we don't talk about it enough. And so, you know, what's interesting in that book, though, is he mentions how in New Zealand they inoculated some Maori, the indigenous people there, and their survival rates were, surprise, surprise, greater. So it was contemporary. It was a contemporary technology that and a procedure that could have been implemented here. But instead, you know, got to get that railroad built and got to put settlers first. And so that's almost like, to me, I think of that when you're like, well, what if the treaties had been honored?
Yeah,
you know, it's like, well, there'd be a lot more of us.
Well, and Canada could have actually benefited a great deal, right? Yeah, in some sense.
Well, I mean, I hate to be reductive, but some days you just, you know, it's just like you either want to share or you don't. and I mean, you got to have the consent of all parties, which is alive. Struggle right now. And look at pipelines. I mean I'd love somebody to just do science fiction, which is what science fiction often does, just take literal these circumstances, change the name, change the skin colors, change the whatever, and say, wow, isn't that horrible what's going on planet Zingdon, you know? It's like, well, funny story. So, which I guess is what Star Trek was supposedly trying to do.
Succeeded sometimes, failed other times.
I tried to watch on Netflix the original Star Trek. It just went on so long. Like, I would love someone to do recuts of them, just like 22-minute cuts of the original Star Treks, right? Because, I don't know.
I mean, they do it for animes. Yeah, they do it for animes, so they could definitely do it for Star Trek.
And it's funny, it reminds me too, like sometimes I'll watch some of my favorite scenes from old movies. Like I love the entry scene from Terminator 2. Like I just think that's funny. But I don't want to watch the whole Terminator 2. And I wish someone would take all the best stuff, string them together, and then put in between, just like the old fashioned movies where you have text and just say, and then this happened, and then this happened. Okay, here's the next awesome scene, right? And it's kind of like a super cut, but you know what I mean? Like, because you may need that context and background to fully appreciate the story. But anyway, so if you could make that happen somehow, that'd be great. Okay.
Well, if not us, then someone out there.
It's a great idea.
I don't have enough RAM. I don't have enough RAM to do video editing right now. So
that's right. Okay. But yeah, no, if the treaties were upheld, I mean, treaties are living documents. I mean, NAFTA, right? I mean, we see that things change over time, and yet somehow, you know, people can't make the analogy between the two, right? And so I think people see, well, those are those, you know, simple treaties, you know, they really were just about, they were means to an end. They had their fingers crossed behind the back. You can't take those seriously. I'm kind of like, well, you know what you're saying? Like, you're undoing the legitimacy of Canada. If you're saying that these documents don't hold water, then Indigenous rights are completely untouched, unaffected by that. So it's kind of in your interest, and which Supreme Court justice is sort of understood.
Yeah.
We're all treaty people, right? It's not just Indigenous people that are treaty people.
Takes two to tango, takes two to treaty.
So. Exactly. Like the colonialists, colonists,
sure.
Are a part of the treaty. You can't just say, oh, this treaty affects you, but I'm not part of it. Like,
that's right.
I don't have to be a part of this.
I don't benefit from this. It's like,
yeah.
And well, I think the interesting thing of this person's potential exploration of what if the treaty is, well, then chances are the populations would be more resilient. There'd be a lot more knowledge exchange to mutual benefit, one hopes. And instead of having one population like Quebec being in a position of strength, having a distinct culture through a concerted effort to create an apparatus for films and books and other forms of expression, you would have that times 60, because that's roughly the number of linguistic cultural groups in Canada that are distinct. Like I often say, if you took a Haida person who only spoke Haida from Haida Gwaii, what's called Queen Charlotte Islands or whatever imposed name it is, put him in a room with someone who spoke Mi'kmaq on the East Coast, they'd be like, I have no idea what this person is saying, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And it would just be fascinating, right? So yeah. It would set up potentially some interesting dynamics, and there might not be a Canada.
Right.
Or it might be a union, like the European Union. It'd just be all sorts of different dynamics.
Yeah, there's so many options that you could take from there and just pick something to write several stories about. Yeah. You could have an entire anthology of what if the treaties were actually in place.
And I am pretty sure there are people who are interested in using futurism as a way to say, well, if we want to see this future come into being, let's depict it. And so that's like, well, what would it look like if Indigenous peoples were to rebound in this incredible way in terms of their languages and in terms of their traditions and just all their institutions? What would that look like? And in a way, lay down, it inspires people, right? You need a vision to take you forward. And I suppose that some of the most interesting science fiction does that. And so I think, yeah, so many times we're like just trying to get people to understand, okay, you know why we have these disproportionate indicators socially, economically, health-wise, it's because of what happened before. And I think people are now trying to pivot and say, well, yes, let's never forget and let's keep that alive because it lives in us, right? I mean, my mother's a residential school survivor. So it's not like back in the old days. It's like, no, it's not even in living memory. It's living. Yeah. Some of those schools, yeah, did not. I mean, they were slightly different than the original mandates of those schools, but still nonetheless, I think we need people to do the work of inspiring us for tomorrow. And then implicit in that will be maybe steps toward that. So yeah. That aspect of speculative fiction by Indigenous people is what, who knows, might actually inspire me to read more fiction than I currently do now.
Yeah, and I think that's why science fiction, one of the reasons that science fiction is so important, is it imagines new things. Mm-hmm. And it's not just new spaceships and new technologies, but it's new ways of living and new relationships and... Yeah, it's so broad as to what can be included in science fiction as a new technology.
And it just has, you know, the challenge, of course, is plausibility, right?
Yes.
I mean, and you know, you have to be able to suspend disbelief, and the rules have to all be, you know, consistent. Like friends and I were critiquing The Walking Dead, right? About just why wouldn't they just all go up north and then they'll just freeze the zombies, right? I mean, so why would you stay in Georgia? I mean, I know they get tax breaks on filming there, but I don't know. So, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. You brought up Star Trek before. Mm-hmm. And I
don't want to talk about Chakotay, please.
Okay. I won't then. Well, thanks very much for doing this with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. Oh, thank you. Well, I mean, yeah, please continue to not do what the panel conveners do at some sci-fi conventions. And yeah, please do a show. Please track down Kutcha, Rebecca, all these, Sherry, all these folks. I'd love to hear what the conversations with them might be like, if there's space for that in your format.
Yeah.
Super. Maybe, or who knows, maybe we could team up, do some sort of event with them. Wouldn't that be great?
That would be super.
We have three people already, right? I mean, yeah. Is Edmonton a big sci-fi, like where would you rank it in Canada, North America for sci-fi devotees? I mean, is it just a coincidence that you're both based here, that's the, you know what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
Edmonton has a mind-boggling number of, like, I don't even want to say Mystery Science Fiction, but like nerd podcasts.
There you go.
Like we are one of Legion here. So there's definitely we have so many comic book stores. I don't know how we support them all. So I think there's interest here. I don't know where we rank relatively, but I think this could be. We have a Marshall feels. Do you feel differently?
No.
No. Yeah. I feel like there is a weird culture here about it, and I think one of the things for good and for ill too. Yeah, I think because science fiction always brings with it. The what I call the salty white dude contingent, they like stories about war and space colonization and
has anyone written a science fiction look ahead on how they're going to deal with all the decommissioned oil wells in a way that actually won't bankrupt the province?
Now you're talking fiction. You really are.
In the future.
Well, I mean,
we will eat oil.
That's maybe the plan. I think one of the things Marshall and I actually went to the oil sands in the early 2000s, or the end of the noughts, and we were there. And what the representative from Suncor actually told us is that we were talking about, so we have these contracts and we're going to put them all back just the way they were before. And then, talking on later and like, so who owns, like, someone asked who owns Suncor? And like, well, we have five secret partners and basically, like, and the company has no revenue and no profits. It gives away all of its oil to its partners. And so then that made me think, well, what happens? So, but the deals are with Suncor, and Suncor has no, Suncor is a shell held by five shadowy secret figures. I mean, how long do you think Suncor is going to stick around when the time to be accountable occurs?
Well, I mean, they'll have sold their wells long before.
Well, it's funny. Have you guys talked? I mean, as you know, it's funny we didn't talk about this one thing, Avatar, right? Which is supposed to be, it's a very problematic film from an indigenous perspective. It's basically Lieutenant Dunbar in space, as somebody once called it, Dances with Wolves reference. Yeah. Dances with Wolves reference. And, but from what I understand, like, the production design was based heavily on the oil sands. So it's, Yeah, maybe we could. I think we'd be very, very interested. Actually, what am I saying? There's already an event that does it. You guys should get yourselves down there. Maybe we can meet up. It's called Indigenous Comic Con, and it's got a lot. It's just had its second year. They're actually looking to do a Canadian version, or what would you call that? Like a sub event, or I don't know what the lingo is, but there's always offshoots of main events, and then they have other events staggered. But Indigenous Comic Con, look that up.
Okay,
I'm just like throwing all these ideas at you.
No, this is the thing we've been doing lately. Because up until this point, we were just like two people, in darkness. And then and Marshall went to Comic Con. Oh, if you just ask people, they'll talk to you. This is a very new revelation to us. So it's wonderful. We're out there and we're meeting people, and it's been really
Pandora's box.
Yeah, Pandora's
box. Pun intended.
Well, as long as hope doesn't get out, it's the greatest evil.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for listening. As usual, you can find us on Twitter at AssetDroid. And you can track us down via email at SteveCieve@androidsandassets.ca and Marshall@androidsandassets.ca.
Would you like to find me on Twitter?
Yeah, sure. And Rick, where can people find you online and Media Indigena, of course?
At Media Indigena on Twitter. We just got onto Instagram. I'm not sure why, because I've already got enough social media work to do. You can go to MediaIndigena.com. We're on all the major podcast platforms. We're hosted with Libsyn, but you can find us on Apple, like on iTunes. You can find us on Stitcher and the like. So me personally, I'm on Twitter at the Rick Harp. Harp like the instrument or the logger. And you can also, if you follow Media Indigena on Twitter, you can find all the Twitter handles of all the roundtablers as well, and highly recommend it. And another idea, so you'll have to edit this in earlier, is talk to Kim, sit down with Kim, talk. Maybe this will be one of the panels, is we'll just go through any half-assed attempts to engage indigenous people in a scientific way, and get Kim to just basically interrogate it to within an inch of its life, and just all the failed propositions, right? So
she has a enormous intellect.
Yeah, exactly.
It boggles the mind when you hear her speak. Exactly. Yeah, for sure. Okay. Well, thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Have a good one.